decided that I'm going to go after the monkeys. So I found out Peter Tork was teaching music on the west side of Manhattan. So I invited him to one of my Happy Together shows.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys.
I sell 28,000 tickets in Chicago. I sell 30,000 tickets in Detroit at Pine Knob.
Cheer up, Sleepy Gene. Oh, what can it mean to a daydream believer and a homecoming queen?
That was something that Rod heard. You know, it was a line. That was the line. And Rod heard that. We were in Vanilla Fudge, and we were doing great. We had three albums on the charts, a hit single. And we took a new band on tour with us. His name was Led Zeppelin.
Set me free, watch out, you babe. Get out my life, watch out, you babe. You really don't want me. You just keep me hanging on.
Hello and welcome to The Rock Podcast. I'm Denny Somach with my co-host, Anita Gevinson.
Anita. Hey, Denny.
How you doing?
We had a great time with Carmine Appice. You know, I had met him before, but neither of us remembered. you introduced me to him, and he was like, hey, nice to meet you. And I'm like, hey, nice to meet you. And then I found a picture of us together.
Okay. Anyway, you can probably tell today's episode, we spent some time with Carmine Appice. He is really, truly a rock star. Come on. His book is out, Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. And I would have to say that he is probably the only other guy that's in the same league as Gene Simmons when it comes to crazy stuff on the road and crazy girls and everything else. But I'll let you have to read the book because we didn't really talk to him too much about his book. And then part two of this episode, we talk with a guy named David Fischoff. Now, you know, you might not recognize the name, but he's the guy behind the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. If you've heard about that, where you go to camp for a week and you have like Roger Daltrey as a counselor, or if you're a guitar player, you have, Joe Perry as your counselor. If you're a drummer, Alan White is your counselor, whatever it is. And you do that. And it's for like regular people who want to be rock stars for a week. And it's turned out to be a big hit. They have a movie out now based on it, and it's in the top 10. And so he talks about that. He's also the guy, he's a very innovative guy. He's the guy who came up with the idea of putting Ringo with other musicians and calling it Ringo Star and the All-Star Band. And that's been going on for 25, 28 years now. And also, he actually started as a sports agent. And you'll hear all this in his conversation. But he's the one that decided to put the Monkees back together in the mid-80s. And that sort of got all these other groups excited enough to start reforming. So very innovative guy. So you'll hear Carmine in the first half. And Anita and I will be here to guide you along. Carmine.
Hello.
Hey, dude. Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
Okay. Were you in Florida?
Mm-hmm.
What part?
Down near West Palm.
This is Anita, my co-host.
Hi, Anita, your co-host. Hi. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
I'm a big Cactus fan, so that's an added plus.
You heard the record, right?
Yeah, I heard it. Now, let me ask you my big Cactus question that I've been waiting for 30-some years to ask. Okay. First of all, love the first album, Parchment Farm, Let Me Swim, mm-hmm. all that stuff. Okay, then you had the second one. And then the third
Let Me Swim was the beginning was Eruption. You know that, right?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. If you listen to the beginning of Let Me Swim and the beginning and you listen to Eruption, it's an extended version of the intro to Let Me Swim.
Mm. Okay.
And the guys in Van Halen told me that when I first met them years ago.
Great to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, so then you do the live album, then the band disappears, and then I was a DJ in upstate Pennsylvania. I got hired to MC this concert, and I had gotten the album for this band. And it's Son of Cactus. What's with that? What's with that? Come on.
Well, that's the Son of Cactus. That's what it was.
What's the connection?
Dwayne Hitchings was the connection.
Right.
He was my good buddy. He was in the Cactus band, the second Cactus band.
Right.
And Pete French, Dwayne Hitchings, Werner Fritsching, me and Tim. So when me and Tim went with BBA, you know, Dwayne said, do you mind if I keep Cactus going? And we said, no, you know, better keep it going than making it die. We did all that work to get it going.
Yeah.
So they did a deal on Atlantic.
Right.
And it was the Son of Cactus.
Okay. And
actually, it was a cool name.
Yeah. I hadn't encountered that, but I was supposed to introduce them at this concert. And I think where's Carmine? Where's, you know? Anyway, well, let's listen to Cactus from the first album and then listen to Eruption by Eddie Van Halen. And this song is Let Me Swim, and then you'll hear Eruption. Sounds like Carmine is right. They're the same.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, I think that Eddie Van Halen was playing with the kind of passion that you play when you're paying homage to somebody rather than just ripping it off.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I agree.
Okay. All right.
So anyway, let's get back to part two of our conversation. More talk about his various bands, including the highly acclaimed group with Jeff Beck, Beck Bogart, and At Peace, and his time with Rod Stewart. You know, he co-wrote Do You Think I'm Sexy and Young Turks and a bunch of other stuff, but he'll talk about that, I think, in part three. So here's part two of our interview with Carmine Appice. So anyway, I interviewed him when the last Cactus album came out, and I think you told me you got together to do the album because you were going to do some festival dates in Europe, and that's...
Was it with the Black Dawn album? Yeah, we did do a bunch of dates. We went to Japan and Europe and all that. And with the new band that's on this new album, we went to Europe and a lot of dates in America.
What's this thing with you and Japan? Because, you know, BBA was big there. I mean, you've always played there.
Well, I think it stems from BBA. We were one of the first bands to play the Budokan after the Beatles and sell it out, you know. And, since then, I was always big in Japan. And as a matter of fact, when I went there with Rod Stewart, 2 years later, we played Nagoya, the first gig. And I told Rod that I'm pretty well-known in Japan. He knew I was well-known because we toured with Cactus with the Faces. And every night I did a solo and everybody loved the solo and, you know, the audiences loved it. So when I joined Rod, he said, you'll have a solo every night. And that's when I came up with the name Appice instead of Apice because everyone called me Appice. And Rod said, we need one way to say your name. You're like three different people now. I said, okay. So he would say Carmine Appice on the drum. So when we played Nagoya, he came out after my solo and the audience response was so amazing. He was saying Carmine Appice on the drums. He couldn't even hear himself from the applause and the screaming. So after the show, he called me up to his suite. He used to always have the suite on the top of the hotel. I used to call him Howie. He goes, why do you call me Howie? I said, it's like Howard Hughes. You're always up in the top and you can't come out, you know? So he said, wow, that was unbelievable, your response. I said, dude, I told you I have a big name in Japan. Mm. So and he said, well, we're going to do a press conference in Tokyo. And I want you to sit next to me. I'm sure you'll get a lot of questions. And he was right. I did get a lot of questions. And it went on. It was great. So ever since then, you know, I mean, I did my Guitar Zeus project in Japan. I did so many different things in Japan.
All right. So after that was over, Jeff did what? Is that when he did Blow by Blow?
Yeah. And I was involved in Blow by Blow. But
you were. Your fingerprints are on there? Where?
Well, in songwriting, which he doesn't admit it today, you know, But, you know, I mean, it just, I went in and I played on it with him. And during BBA days, I turned him on to that jazz rock stuff, you know. And So when the BBA broke up, I went to England and I said, hey, let's do something like Mahavishnu, you know? And so we started working on material. I rehearsed with him, with Max and Phil Chen and all that. And I recorded 5 or 6 songs with George Martin, which I have like on my computer. Some of them were left and some of them were, you know, replaced, but we couldn't come up with a deal. You know, like his manager wanted it to be a Jeff Beck album. While we were doing it, we're talking about either a Jeff Beck album or a Beck A Piece album. Cause you know, we just come out of the BBA thing. It was big, you know, and it made him bigger and it made me bigger. So a Beck A Piece album would have been cool, but they wanted it to be a Jeff Beck album, not a Jeff Beck group, just a Jeff Beck album. And so we said, can we do a featuring or something? And they couldn't come up with something. And then I just realized recently, I did all that work over there for months and I never got paid a dime, you know?
It seems to be the way it went a lot of times.
Yeah, well, not for me, usually. I had managers, you know, that was supposed to take care of that. But you know, we ended up friends.
So you're in Brooklyn, you're a kid. Was it a musical household? Did you know about Buddy Rich being from Brooklyn?
I mean, my cousin was a drummer. Every time we went to his house, I played his drums and I'd go home and bang on the pots and pans, all that stuff. And then
At what age did you?
Toy drum sets and broke them. Then I got a small real drum set and I was into it. And then I started taking lessons. And then I got a real drum set, and then I started doing gigs. When I was 17, I got out of high school. I was making, back in 1964, like $200 a week just playing gigs, and then working all week in something in New York City, making $45. I finally said to my father, I said, look, I work on a weekend and make $200 cash, and I work all week. I get up at 5 and 6 in the morning, take the train, go to Manhattan, work all day, get back at 7, 5 days a week. I come home with $45. I said, what would you do? 45 or 200? And he said, well, I guess the 200 sounds better. I said, thank you. So that was the last time I had a day job.
So the Pigeons, is this when the Pigeons were formed?
No, this is, I had all different bands. I had the Vidals, I had Thursday's Children, I had the Zany Manhattans, all these things. But we used to play gigs with Thursday's Children in the clubs, and Jimi Hendrix was in the clubs too in New York, called Jimmy James. You know, we used to play all that. So by the time I was 17, I saved up enough money in 1964 to buy a brand new 64 Chevy Super Sport, where I put money down, my parents co-signed, I made the payment. So that was the beginning of my credit and my financial career by doing that. And I was very proud of the fact I was still in high school and I had myself a brand new car that I bought from playing drums.
So you had a singular focus. This was always what you were going to do. There was never a doubt.
Well, at that point, wow. After I finished doing that job, then I said, look, I had a drum teacher. He used to make $1,000 a week back in 64, teaching, playing gigs. I said, that's what I want to do. And I remember one time when I met Hendrix, we played a gig together. He was Jimmy James. And we went up to this, in the Upper West Side where we have an apartment now, it was Panic in Needle Park. I don't know if you know that movie.
Yes.
It was all drug prostitutes, right. You know, low-life people. So during a break where we both had a break and they played some records, we went up to some black hookers, or should you say a female Afro-American hooker, to be proper today, to her apartment. We were smoking some pot, and Jimmy would look out the window and he said, man, I want to make it one day in the record business. And I said, what about you? I said, I just want to make a living, you know, playing drums. I'm good. And next time I saw him after that, he was in London. He was Jimi Hendrix and I was in Vanilla Fudge. And I told him, he said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm in Vanilla Fudge. He goes, man, I love the Fudge. We were the Pigeons, and Atlantic didn't like the name the Pigeons, so... So you like White Soul, Vanilla Fudge. I said, oh, that's a cool name. And everything was Strawberry Alarm Clock and stupid names. So Vanilla Fudge fit in, you know?
All right. So that's the real story of how the band got the name, not from a girl whose nickname was Vanilla Fudge because she liked ice cream.
No.
Okay.
So, Carmine, let me ask you a question. You know, they're making a movie of Ahmet Erdogan. You got any Ahmet Erdogan stories?
They're making one or they made it?
No, they're making a movie of his life. No, I want to ask you if you had any Ahmet Erdogan stories. Because everybody that was on Atlantic does.
I do. I mean, I think that the Ahmet Erdogan, the one I have, actually ruined our career. Even though he was the guy that signed us in the first album, did amazing. And then him and George Morton, Shadow Morton, came up with this idea to do this concept album as a second album that ruined our career. All we had to do is what we did on the first album. Hmm. Not this huge, ridiculous concept album. As we were doing it, we were saying, what the hell are we doing? And Shadow would say, oh, don't worry, this is going to be the biggest thing since the Sgt. Pepper. And it ruined our album. It ruined our career. We had to rush in and do a third album. And it was him and Ahmet that did it.
So you're at home and you're growing up and you get your first record and everybody remembers their first album. What was your first album that you ever got?
Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich album, drum battle album. And everybody thinks I'm going to say the Beatles or something like that. You know, I thought the Beatles sucked back then, to tell you the truth. You know,
based on?
They sucked. I mean, come on. I was into James Brown and horns and when they came out, by the time they came out, and you know, by the time they came out, I was already playing.
And you were brought up with Motown and doo-wop and R&B.
Yeah, I used to sing doo-wop in the streets of Brooklyn. I used to sing it and play. And we used to play R&B and rock, and we never played Beatles. Right. When they came out, we used to put on Beatle wigs and sing dirty versions of their song at weddings. Not until they did Revolver did I take notice. I did take notice of Day Trip, it was pretty cool, but I listen now to the early Beatles and I know, I realize, you know, with the songwriting and stuff that they're amazing and what Ringo has done as a drummer, you know, but back then, you know, it didn't even appeal to me at all.
And then choosing to cover the Holland Dozier Holland song.
Well, you got to understand what was going on in Long Island, and everybody was doing what we call production numbers. It started from the Rascals, you know, so, and then the Vagrants started, and they were drawing crowds of 2,000 people in my manager's club in Long Island. And then Mark and Timmy came into a club where I was playing in Jersey, and they said they want to do this new kind of music, you know, with production numbers, they called it, but they needed a drummer who could sing, a drummer who can play technically and had a good right foot, you know, and all that stuff. So I went out and played with them and I said, wow, these guys are great. Mark Stein's voice is unbelievable. And keyboard playing, Tim Bogert's bass playing. So I joined them and then we went to see the Vagrants. So I knew from before, because when I was playing the R&B, the Vagrants opened up for me in a club. I had a big 6-piece band with horns and everything. We used to wear pinstripe suits and hair teased up and stuff. And the Vagrants opened up for us. And they looked like grungy Rolling Stones, you know. They got big by doing these production numbers. And Leslie West, they used to sing like Respect, Slow Down. They did Satisfaction, Slow Down. So we started taking the concept. But then we took more of a concept of listening to the lyrics and trying match the lyrics to the music. So like You Keep Me Hanging On, when it was done, like Set Me Free, Why Don't You, Babe? You know, it was hurting lyrics, but it sounded like a party, happy song. So we took it down and gave it the emotion. So we did that with all the songs we did, and that was our concept. And we had four voices and four-part harmony. With the other bands in that era only had maybe one voice, maybe another harmony. But we had the harmony, we had the playing, you know, we were with the best of the musicians. And that song was a one-take mono. And we recorded,
I read that.
I would say 7.5 minutes to change my life.
So in this part, Carmine talks, again, we start with You Keep Me Hanging On because it was a hit twice. And then how Rod Stewart got caught when it was revealed that the song he co-wrote, Do You Think I'm Sexy, was stolen from a Brazilian musician, Jorge Ben. We get to the bottom of it. So here it is. Here's Carmine Appice, part three.
Well, it was a hit the first time, but a small hit.
Right.
You know, it started it off for us. And then July, hit the charts July of 67. And I joined the band November 66. I always say to them, see, I joined the band 9 months later, he had a record on the charts. You know, but we're working on a new track now called "Stop in the Name of Love" that has Tim on it. It's the last thing Tim ever recorded, and it's got the same kind of power and the same lyric concept. And we're going to try and release it on the same date that we released "Hanging On" in June. And if we do, it's going to be the 55th anniversary of the band releasing their first single with tribute to Tim and Mary Wilson.
Is this the Supreme Fudge project?
It will be. You know, right now it's just a single.
Okay.
If it goes well, then we'll do a whole album.
Wow, that's great. That's great.
I love the way I loved "My World Is Empty" on your reunion album.
I liked it too. That was Jeff Beck on guitar.
Right.
J.B. Toad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we ended up being friends all through, you know, these times, you know. And even "People Get Ready," I was involved in "People Get Ready."
So why do you think?
But of course, I got no credit, and I never got paid for that either.
Yeah. But wait a minute. Since we're talking song credits, "Do You Think I'm Sexy?" Now, what did you write? The music or the lyrics?
No, I didn't write lyrics.
Okay, so you wrote the music. So
I wrote music.
What happened with the Jorge Ben thing?
Well, that was something that Rod heard. You know, it was a line. That was the line. And Rod heard that, and she used to go to South America for the soccer matches. So he must have heard it somewhere, and it came up. And so they worked it out, you know.
I
don't know how they worked it out, but they worked it out somehow.
Well, apparently he gave the lyric. He gave his the money to the UN or something, right?
Rod gave his money for the I don't know if it's forever, but for a certain release of it, he gave to the UNICEF.
Right.
Right. But he sued for writing credit, and Rod gave it to him.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Not on that song. He worked out something else where he gave him credit for another song on the next album.
Oh, okay.
Oh, because it was already out and he couldn't do it.
Yeah, it was done. It was already done.
I see. You know? Okay. So they figured what it would have.
It was me, Rod, and my buddy Dwayne Hitchens, who was in Cactus, son of Cactus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he was a keyboard player that had a studio that I went to when I had the chord structures and everything. I said, "You'll make this sound better." And we presented Rod with a full demo of it, and he loved it, and that's how we got it. And Dwayne participated in some of the writing, so he got his share, which started his career off as a writer. He also wrote Young Turks, and then he wrote Infatuation with Rod and a couple other things, and Alice Cooper and all kinds of people.
Because the Stones had put out "Miss You," right?
Right, and that was what Rod wanted.
Right.
He said to the band, "I want a song like "Miss You," "Missing You," whatever.
Well, it's hard to remember how big that whole disco movement was. It didn't really matter who you were.
Yeah,
everybody,
it was huge.
But
it's funny enough, when we first recorded it with three guitars, Dwayne Hitchens on keyboard, bass, drums, it was massive. It sounded really rock, you know? And then Tom Dowd said, "Okay, now let me do my thing." And he put Tom Scott on there. He put David Foster on there. He put an orchestra on there playing the line. He put Jim Cregan's wife, who was Linda Lewis, who was an English singer. Anyway, so Linda Lewis sang the height, like two octaves up of that line. So before you know it, instead of being on one big 24 track, we're on two 24 tracks filled up. So when you do that, the whole sound shrinks. And it sounded more disco-y rather than rock. But, you know, we were all a bit disappointed. And if you watch the video, like, I didn't even know the drum fills yet, you know, because, you know, we had just recorded it. And I never, you know, write anything down where I'm going to play exactly the same thing twice. Every take we did, the drum part was a little different. But when it came out and went to number one in so many countries, I was like flabbergasted. So was Rod, you know. I remember we were in Australia when it went to number one in America. He said, "Okay, our song's number one. We got to buy the band and crew dinner tonight. It cost $3,000. So I said, I didn't make a dime on it yet. You know, I'm putting out $1,500 for a dinner.
And in the final part of our conversation, Carmine recounts his meeting with his idol, Buddy Rich. And all you have to do is go on YouTube, Buddy Rich, and Celebration is a good one to start. And if you just want to see why he's so many, not just Carmine's, but so many drummer and musicians.
Oh, Carl
idol.
Palmer says the same thing.
Yeah, just go on YouTube and you won't believe it. It looks like it was done with special effects. So here's Carmine.
So what do you remember about the Zeppelin tours?
What do you want to know?
First time you saw them, I mean.
First time we saw them, we thought they were great. They weren't supposed to be on the show. The show was already sold out. Vanilla Fudge and
Spirit.
Spirit.
Yeah. Iron Butterfly. Who
was? No, Spirit. And yeah. It was in Denver.
So, yeah.
7,500 seat place was sold out. And Barry Fay, the promoter, said to our agent, who was their agent as well, "We don't need him." She says, "Come on, man! It's only $1,500 for Led Zeppelin. We don't need him." So he said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. You pay $750, and Vanilla Fudge will pay $750 because we were making big money then, you know."
Right.
So they said, "Okay." So they came on and played, and we thought they were good. But we heard the album before, and I heard John Bonham's foot on Good Times last time, and I said to him, "Wow, that's great foot part, man. Where'd you get that?" He said, "I got it from you." I said, "Not from me. I don't do that." And he pointed out on one of my albums, which we had three albums out at the time, where I actually did it, you know, except I didn't do it like that. He did it repetitively. I did it like twice. And he just took the concept and, you know, as drummers do, you take a concept and you make it your own. So we loved him. And then he wanted a drum set like mine. And, you know, from seeing them live, I said, "Man, these guys are going to be big because they were really good." You know, so I called Ludwig, and I'll never forget this conversation. And I was just with Bill Ludwig III, who was part of the Ludwig family. And I said, "Listen, we've got this band opening up for us. They're really good. Their name's Led Zeppelin. I think they're going to be big." He wants an endorsement. And I always say that's an understatement of like 5 or 6 decades now, you know. So then he got the same exact drum set as me. And we went on tour the next year. 6 months later, and they were as big as we were, you know, just off their first album. They just released a second album that had the big drums on it. And we both played the same drum set. I often wondered how weird that was when, like, they went on first and they played his drum set, and they take his drum set off, they put my drum set up. Hmm. Probably said, "Hey, why'd they just take the drums off and put the same drum set up?"
You played with them also on the 40th anniversary of Atlantic, right? They played there and you and Vanilla Fudge?
Well, they played there, yeah, but John was gone already.
Right.
Yeah, it was his son played.
Right.
Yeah, we played that with the Rascals and everything.
So your eighth album, Out Through the Indoor?
Mm-hmm.
So whose idea was that, and what was the concept behind that? What was the thinking process?
That was our manager, who's still managing us, Tom Vitorino. He said, "You guys are great at doing, you know, these arrangements. Why don't you do an arrangement album on one artist?" You know, so, you know, we were thinking about the Who or maybe the Doors, and make the Doors more soulful sounding. And then he said, "Well, why don't you do Led Zeppelin?" So you guys are like really close friends and you guys had a lot of relations and similarities. I said, "Okay, that's a good idea."
So you fudgersized their songs.
Yeah, we did it. And then it came out with a label in Europe and went out of business.
Right.
You know, and then
you wouldn't have done it if he hadn't even, that was nothing the band would have ever done if it wasn't the suggestion.
Well, we would have just done, we had a record deal. We just would have done like what we always done, you know. Like, it was his idea to come up with the Supreme Fudge thing as well. You know, he's a visionary kind of guy.
That's a cute idea. I like that.
Yeah, so it's Supreme Fudge, and there'll be five Supreme songs, two or three R&B songs, and then maybe a couple of originals.
Did you ever hear from Holland Dozier or any of the
with the Supremes?
Oh, yeah. We heard from Mary Wilson, rest in peace, you know. Yeah. So we're going to dedicate it to Tim and Mary as well, because they died 3 weeks of each other.
I got to meet Mary.
She loved it. She loved
she
it.
She was lovely.
Holland Doja Holland told me at a Guitar Center, the Rock Walk of Fame that we used to do there. I was on the board of directors for them. And they were getting inducted. And they said, I just got to tell you, your version of You Keep Me Hanging On was the best version anybody has ever done.
Great.
You know? And I said, wow, thank you, man. Coming from you guys, that's like, wow, you know.
Right.
Because, you know, we were like big fans of them. Their songs are so great.
I remember what I wanted to ask you about your meeting with Buddy Rich.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, I was doing drum offs in L.A. You know, the Guitar Center drum off I started. It was called the Carmine Peace Drum Off for 5 years. And the second one we did, my manager was friends with his manager. Actually, it started out with my manager was friends with this club owner at the Starwood. And Buddy was playing the Starwood, and my manager said, oh, we're going to hook up a gig where you play with Buddy at the Starwood. I said, get out of here. I'm not playing with Buddy Rich at the Starwood. You know, he said, no, like you play with his band and he can play with a band you put together. So against my will, they convinced me to do it. And then it fell apart. So then,
understandable.
So then I went to the gig and I knew his daughter, you know, and his daughter went, came up, we were in the VIP, me and my brother, and his daughter came out, said, oh man, I can't believe you came. You know, my father thinks you're one of those assholes that are challenging him to a drum battle like Ginger Baker. I said, no, man, I didn't charge him. Yeah, I told her the story. She goes, oh, that's it? She goes, come in, come meet Buddy. I said, nah, not if he's pissed off at me.
So that's
she goes, no, it'll be all right. So she says, come on in. So I said, Vinny, you come with me. So Vinny comes with me. We go in there, and Buddy says, oh, hey, Dad, and Buddy, she called him, Buddy, this is Carmine. He was going to play. Oh, you mean the guy that challenged me to a drum battle, blah, blah, blah. I said, look, I didn't do that. And I told him the story. He said, that's it? I said, yeah. He says, you smoke? I said, no, I don't smoke. He goes, you smoke? I said, no, I don't smoke. He goes, but do you smoke? I said, what do you mean, pot? I said, yeah, I smoke pot. It was good. He reaches in his pocket and takes out a chocolate joint, a wrap joint, lights it up. Takes it here, gives it to me. I take it here, I'm giving it to Vinny. I'm going, I can't believe this. I'm smoking a joint with Buddy Rich. And I give it to my brother. He's thinking the same thing. And then he goes on and plays, and we were like smashed, you know. And so we became friends. So then we were going to do an album together, direct to disc with Stanley Clarke producing with that concept, me playing with his band, him playing with my band. We couldn't get all of us together.
So I just want to thank Carmine Appice. Great guy. We love having him on. We're going to have him on in the future. His Led Zeppelin stories, he could have gone on forever and ever. We'll probably do a whole episode just with him and that first Zeppelin tour. But we've had him on before. He's a great guest. So anyway, let's turn now to our second guest. This is a guy named David Fischoff. And we're going to start with a discussion of Rock Camp, the movie. Now, it's rated 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, you know, it's got some good reviews. So anyway, here is David Fischoff and a discussion of the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
Artists love to give back. They realize their success is based on the fans.
And that's how I came up with the idea of Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
It's very easy to forget where you came from.
Once Roger started doing it,
it opened up the door.
Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp became part of pop culture.
Just like that.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp.
Woo! Okay, this person can play, this person can kind of play.
You would have a 15-year-old kid playing drums and a dentist on guitar. If this band were a real band, it would be the weirdest band ever, but cool.
A lot of really good players come through.
One guitar player was shredding like a mother, and I'm thinking, what are you? He goes, I'm a doctor. I'm going, wow.
I want every rock star to do what inspires them.
I had to experience it.
If Bob Dylan and Gene Simmons and Jimi Hendrix auditioned for The Voice, you think we'd make it? Oh, it's Valentine. It's Valentine. You think we'd make it?
I see you playing, but get with him. He's great, huh?
Paul Stanley, same. Reminded him of my buddy Miles.
Hey, babe, I'm in the middle of a vocal thing. Ready? Call you back, okay?
Looking forward to another good bashing of Rock Camp.
I've reconnected with my joy of playing.
singing for the first time on stage.
It's a very special thing.
That moment.
And for me and for him, it's real.
I can't think of a more fun thing to do. I mean, it's better than stamp collecting.
Do you like the movie?
Yes, I love the movie. So let's talk about this movie.
Okay, let's go.
First of all, you did the rock camp TV show, which was on VH1, which was like a number one show there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The camp has been exploding. I know you've been going all over the place with it, and now you're doing corporate stuff and everything. Now you're doing the movie. So how did the idea behind the movie?
So Jeff Bro and I hadn't spoken for a long time. When I was doing Dirty Dancing and Jeff was running as a live tour, Jeff was running VH1.
Right.
And we had gotten together and basically we were friends from bed. And then he contacted me about 8 years ago and said to me that he says, you know, you got to make this into a film. And I really want to make a film out of this.
Right.
And I said, on one condition, I said, you got to keep me out of it. Let's do it about the campers. Let's do it about the rock stars.
Right.
And it's a great story to tell. So we did. But he fortunately made a deal. But he came back to me after 2 years. He says, everybody wants your story and your rock and roll fantasy camp. So I said, okay, I'm going to do it. But I really didn't want to. Denny, you know, I did Ringo's tour for many years. And he always promote the other artists. So an interview would come in and would say, it's for Nils Lofgren. You know, he would give an interview and he said, well, give it to Nils. Give it to Joe Walsh. He always wanted to give it to everybody else. So I felt like, you know, I wanted to really promote everybody.
You're making all this stuff happen. So did it turn out the way you hoped it would have?
Well, I have to tell you, after how many times you go to a film and you see it, you see a trailer.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you go to the movie and you're so disappointed. The trailer's so amazing.
Yeah.
That's what Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp is. I can never make a movie or a trailer to tell you how amazing it is. So I'm so happy with the film. It did take 5 years. I think what happened was when Doug Blush came in and he said, David, stay out of the kitchen and let me bake the cake.
Right.
That's when it turned around.
So let's talk a little bit about the history, because I was at the original couple of camps that you had, and I thought it was brilliant and everything. And I watched the whole thing grow. What are you, 25 years in now?
25 years. Yeah, 25 years. And let me tell you something. It hasn't been an easy 25 years. You know, we went through an economy going down. We also have the fear factor. You know,
right. I
mean, how many people, signed up for Jeff Beck and then
right. –
and said, I can't make it. I'll do the next one.
Oh, boy.
You know, the biggest problem you have at rock camp is the fear factor. People are scared to come. And that's why I love the film so much, because I really wanted to show people not to be scared, that these rockers will really help you achieve
right.
your goal.
And now you pivoted. You're doing master classes. That was brilliant.
I kept wanting to find a way during COVID to relate to the campers, because I've always wanted to go online. So I've been really working on it for years and thinking maybe I could do lessons with these people. Maybe I can do, I could come up with different, ways to connect. And back in June, I said, you know, let me try to do a masterclass. And I called Mark Farner and I said, would you do it? And Phil Cavallari, and they both said yes. And I have a great host. I have a Britt Lightning from the band Vixen.
Right.
She's really, really smart musician, and she's been hosting them. And we've done 160 of them.
Wow. You know,
you're talking about a library, Danny. We've got a library of 160 masterclasses. And these aren't artists promoting a record. These are artists just giving information on what drove them, what was their passion.
So of the masterclasses, can you name me the top five popular ones or the most instantly sold out? It's like sold out when it's sold out.
Okay. So, you know, Roger Daltrey, naturally.
Right.
The Desmond Child's masterclass was so brilliant on songwriting.
Right. Yeah.
He did great. Eddie Kramer on mixing music is a great one. Right. You know, Joe Elliott, you know, because he's so popular. Alice Cooper has done great. But, you know, it's just been great to see all these artists connecting. And it's not a cameo. It's not a meet and greet. You're actually talking to these people for 60 minutes. We advertise, but they all turned out to be 2 hours. Alice said to me, I got nowhere to go. So keep asking questions. and the information that they have really given out. Number one, passion. I mean, that's really what's everyone, the common denominator is they all have passion for their careers. And number two, right. The song. It's all about the song. So, you know, you can have, you know, I mean, it's really been interesting. Every night I get off the phone with Britt and I say, wow, I can't imagine what he said. And it's been really fun and exciting. And we're going to keep doing them after COVID too.
How the guitar player lessons must be amazing for the guitarists.
Well, they're great for guitarists. You know, you have, Marty Friedman from Japan and, you know, he's playing away and, you know, giving people. And I loved, for Judas Priest, the guitar, Richie,
right.
He's somebody we're all going to play together, but we're going to trade licks. So, and they're trading licks, you know, I'll play this lick. Let me hear your lick. And they all pull out the guitars. And they're fun. Tonight we have Gary Hoey. It should be amazing.
Who else is coming up on the masterclasses? So
we have Gary Hoey. We have, Randy Bachman.
Right. Great storyteller. One of the greats.
Great storyteller. I mean, his stories, he walked into my camp about 10 years ago. I was at Abbey Road Studios. I said, Randy, thank you for coming. He said, can I get everybody here and you speak to them? And he said, sure. And he, you know, pulled out a guitar. I was mesmerized how he wrote those songs. So he's coming. He's going to do a two-part series. Doug Blush, who directed the film, is going to tell people how to do their own documentaries and be able to guarantee that at the end of four classes, you can enter a film in a film festival. Eddie Kramer
right.
is going to mix six songs live. Uh-huh. You're going to be able to watch Eddie Kramer in action and talking to you why he's doing hearing right. what he's hearing. So, and then Joe Elliott's going to come back and do a class, and Styx is going to do a class. And, you know, these artists have been doing these classes, and they've been donating the money to different charities or to their crews.
Some of your favorite moments in the movie.
Yeah, my favorite moments in the movie, there's so many of them. I think he captured everything. By the way, it could have been 4 hours. You know how they make movies. Everything's right. on the floor, on the cutting floor. I thought Gene Simmons, brilliant in the things he says, how down to earth he is. Same thing with Paul Stanley. I mean, Paul Stanley. So Paul Stanley telling the artist, you could have been Miles Davis. You drum like him.
Right.
And he's choking up. Sammy Hagar, who basically gives away and says, hey, you guys think we know what we're talking about doing on stage here? And him choking at the end and saying, listen, I realized when I went to rock camp, my life has changed. Mm-hmm. Roger Daltrey saying, I was one of them. I just got lucky. I mean, there's so many moments of the film. I can't tell you that so many people have said that, they keep watching it over and over again because they want to capture things. And that was Doug Blush. He did an amazing job. And, you know, we're 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is, you know, quite exciting.
Now, of all the people that you've had over the years, who was the toughest and who still haven't you gotten?
And yes, and Joe Perry, getting Joe Perry was amazing because I think Joe Perry, once he saw I got Jeff Beck, you know how the business is.
Yeah.
You know, and Joe Perry came and he wrote me a thank you note afterwards. He says, I cannot believe how this affected me. And a week later, I'm writing my book and I got inspired. And so Joe has been back a few times and he's been amazing. And,
yeah.
and what he gives to campers is so incredible. Listen, the late Peter Tork, he was tough. He
right.
was tough. He called me up and said, David, I want to do a camp. And I said, okay, Peter, but it's a lot of work. And then he said to me, I can do it. And he came and it was really hard for him because, you know, meeting the fans
right.
and, just being on top of them. But in the end, he pulled it off. I would say the ones I want to get. Well, I love that Mick and Keith did The Simpsons. So that's great.
Right.
My ultimate would be a Paul McCartney. You know, my ultimate would be, any of the Rolling Stones. I mean,
well, you had Bill Wyman. What was that like?
Bill Wyman. Wow, Bill Wyman was amazing. I asked him to come for 2-3 hours. He came for 12, and he didn't want to leave. And it was 6 o'clock. He was there since 9 o'clock in the morning, and it was like 7 o'clock. And I wanted to. It was Friday, so Denny Illins.
Right, yeah, right.
It was
sure.
Sabbath. I wanted to go for the Sabbath, and I never forget. I turned to Bill. I said, "Well, don't you want to go home?" He said, "No, I got no rush. My family's away for the weekend. Where else do you want me to jam?" And I said, well, I have to leave because it's the Sabbath. And he looked at his watch. He said, well, the Sabbath didn't start in Los Angeles. That's how smart he was. He was so smart. Bill White was incredible. One of my favorite is Nick Mason from Pink Floyd.
Right.
I asked Nick to come for 2-3 hours. And we had a mutual friend, so he agreed to come. And 4 days later, he's there, drumming with one of the bands. He stayed for 4 days.
Right.
And he said, I never get to play with Mickey Dolenz, the Monkees. He said, right. I never get to play this kind of music. He was so sweet. And then he calls me up and says, do you mind if I write an article about this in GQ? And he wrote an 8-page article about his experience at Rock Camp. So, it's been great. Once they come, they get it. They walk in those doors and they realize, I'm just a musician. Let's go.
Right. So what would you say? I think I read, so you had like over 6,000 participants, or is it higher than that now?
No, we've had about 6,000 participants. But again, we've done a lot of camps. We're going to continue it. I'm going to try to I want to go on tour with it to do one day camps. Because, I realize many people can't travel. They want to perform in front of their families.
Right.
I'm here in Florida now trying to get, Florida, I think, is more open. So I want to try to get camps going in October, at least get one or two camps under my skin and get them going. The Scorpions said they're going to do a camp for me, but then there'll be March in 2022. I think the big artists, the older artists are a lot more hesitant to come out this year. And I think that's basically because they need a full arena to perform.
Right. Well, if you get the Florida one together, let me know. We'll cover it live.
Please, you have to come.
All right, so let's.
Danny, I will have to say, the fun part, the key part in the film is seeing these four people and how their lives changed. That's Scott Keller from McKinsey is unbelievable, and he's become a great friend. They've all become good friends, but just to see how their lives have changed is just incredible.
What's the repeat factor? How many people come back?
Oh, well, that's the good news. The good news is they come back. People tell me I'm in the cocaine business because once they taste Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, they got to keep coming back.
Right.
And so they 50% come back at every camp the minute I go on sale. And the 50% are signed up right away. The fun part is that how many of the artists have said to me, David, you won't believe I saw this person in the front row. I see all your campers in the front row of my shows. And I say, you know why? Because you let them jam with you. So they're not going to sit 2 rows or 5 rows back. They want to be on that stage with you. So they're all buying the front row tickets. And so many of them, have just gone on to make their best friends. As a Kip Winger tells me his best friends are from Rock Camp. They all do. Even Sammy, even Steven Tyler. I mean, he walked away. His best friend at camp, was a gentleman. They fly in planes together now. So.
Right.
The relationship that these artists have made at camp has just been incredible.
Now, is there any kind of average? I mean, you probably have a lot of executives, right?
You get them now all ages. It really depends on the band. So I always do one or two kid bands because there's great musicians out there you want to give this opportunity to. And I don't operate kids if they, I want serious musicians. So that's Then you get them at, ages 45 to 60. Again, depending on the artist, but if you get Tommy Lee, when he did the Bahamas, 50% were women. So I love it that you get, I want to get more women into Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. Nancy Wilson brings over 50% of women. Right. So we're thinking about doing some women's only camps too. And,
Brandon's
out now.
You had Lita Ford, right, recently?
Oh, Lita Ford's amazing. Yeah, she's great. She's been a counselor. She's been a guest. She's been a tremendous guest at Rock Camp.
So people will get a real idea if they see the movie, but if they decide they want to go, what do they do? I know they can download a sample itinerary. Where do people go? What's your website?
First, get on my email blast because that's really gives you all the information. Rockcamp.com. And rockcamp.com, it gives you all the information, the master classes that we're doing, that we're doing now. We'll give you notice when the new camps will start up. Hopefully, again, like I said, October in Florida, I will let you know. And the movie, Rock Camp, the movie, it's on Amazon, on Apple, it's on Fandango, it's all the platforms.
Well, that's David Fischoff. And Anita, do you have a rock fantasy like going to band camp?
I would do it under one condition. Only if, well, obviously it couldn't be both Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, because, you know, Walter's no longer with us. But if they could bring him back to life and Donald and Walter could perform at the band camp and I could be one of Steely Dan's backup singers. That's my rock fantasy. Okay. I would love to be one of the Danettes.
Okay. So yeah. We're going to get into part two of our conversation with David Fischoff. And this is where he talks about getting the idea of putting the Monkees back together and putting them on tour.
What yeah. That's
like.
Well, you know, the Monkees, I can still remember. I mean, I'm making my Monkees 13-year-old girl face now, or maybe I was 15, but the Monkees, my first concert, you always remember your first. That's what they say. And it was in July of 1967 at the Philadelphia Convention Hall. I wore my bloomer dress. I don't know if people remember what a bloomer dress was. It was like a really short dress, but then you had matching pants.
Oh, yes.
But like bloomers, because otherwise it'd be like you were in your underwear.
Right.
And my father drove me to the show and then came back and picked me up and just screamed my ass off the whole time. And my mother made cookies and I brought cookies to the Monkees and put them on the stage. And yeah, Davy Jones, he was my fave. I was a big fan of the TV show, which started the year before in 66, inspired by A Hard Day's Night. Which I guess makes sense now with all the running and the whole thing.
Sure.
And to get the Monkees together, there was an ad in Daily Variety in the Hollywood Reporter, and it said, seeking folk and roll, not rock and roll, folk and roll for acting roles in a new TV series. And one of the, as we were joking earlier, one of the guys who went down to the audition was Stephen Stills. And had he not had that horrible tooth thing.
Right. Bad
this
teeth.
This was before he got his teeth fixed. And if he had had the dental work before, we would never have had Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
That's
he would have been a Monkee.
That's right. Stephen Stills came in fifth. Believe it or not. He was very good friends with Peter Tork.
I don't know why I find that so funny, but okay. Anyway.
All right. So anyway, let's get to this part two of our interview with David Fischoff.
After the 60s rock and roll band, the Monkees got off the last train to Clarksville and wound up at Manhattan's Hard Rock Cafe today. Davy Jones, Peter Tork, and Mickey Dolenz, three of the original Monkees, are staging a 20th anniversary comeback.
It's something we're all looking forward to with, you know, great excitement. And it's fun. The Monkees was fun. It was about happy. There was nothing, as Mickey always says, it wasn't brain surgery.
Of course, Monkees, he's wrong about that. But
the Monkees was a great fun time. The music was happy. And we have that same feeling as we go onto the stage now, even though we're all 20 years older.
If you're wondering about the fourth member of the group, Michael Nesmith, well, as you can see, he dropped in for the news conference. But the Monkees say he could not make it for their four-month tour. The Monkees play in Atlantic City this Friday, then they'll be back in New York for two concerts, July 16th and July 27th.
Three guys who don't monkey around are Peter, Mickey, and Davey. The Monkees are back on the charts and out on a four-month tour, and they told us how it feels.
No, I'm scared to death!
Whereas I am cool, calm, and collected.
I made your reservation, don't be slow. No.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got to this point, because most people don't know. I mean, I know you were a sports agent when you started, but the thing that really put you on the map was the Monkees reunion tour, correct? How did you come up with that, and what did that take?
So I started my career as a sports agent representing the Lupinellas, Lupinella and Randy Myers and Phil Sims, and you know, it was fun, and sharing office space with Shep Gordon and the late Gary Kerfus. And we were up on the seventh floor at 7075 Broadway. And Meatloaf's manager was there. And Madonna's manager was there. And, you know, you were walking around this place and there were gold records and, you know, artists coming. And I remember the Ramones coming in, the B-52s to see Gary, his client. I remember Alice coming in to see and Luther Vandross. And, you know, here I was in the sports business. I was sitting in my office. I would negotiate a contract for a ball player. And then, you know, 3 years later, you know, I'd do it again. And I was talking with these players, but I wanted to be creative. You know, I'm a creative person, I felt. And while being a sports agent, it was show me the money. So I decided that let me try my hand in the music business. I saw those gold records on the wall. And I got a call one day from a press agent. And he says to me, are you interested in representing the association? And I wrote, the association of what? I never heard of the association. So he says, well, they're looking for a manager and they're a music band from the 60s. And, you know, why don't you check them out? And I, you know, I called them back. I said, yeah, I'm interested. And they said they were with the William Morris Agency. So they were looking for a new manager. So I flew to California and the band, I walk into a studio and the band's ready to audition and they want to play for me their new album. And I say, play me the old stuff. That's the stuff I'll recognize. And I started hearing Cherish and Windy and Never My Love. And I remembered all that music for the dentist office. So I said, you know what? I'm going to give this a shot. Let me try the music business. And I was honest with him. And I said, I'll do my best. I know the agents at William Morris because I do book corporates. And they said, okay, go for it. So I started taking on the association. I went to see every agent at the Morris office. And I said, then would you start booking this band? And they looked at me and said, oh, you nuts. You're the biggest sports agent in New York. You got all these players. Why are you doing this? I said, I want to be in the music business. And they were all really generous. And they said, okay, we'll help you out. And they booked them everywhere. And I got offers to book in Chicago Fest and then into Grossinger's and the Catskills and then LA. Now, Denny, I knew nothing about routing a tour, you know, because so I would say yes to Thursday night at Grossinger's at 10 o'clock and then 4 o'clock to L.A. show the next day. Because, you know, if you fly from New York to L.A. at 9 o'clock in the morning, you get there at 12 o'clock, you can drive to Orange County an hour later and you can make a show. I knew nothing about sound check, gear. I just and every time I called the band, I said, hey, would you, should I take this gig? Should I take this gig? And they would say to me, you're the manager. It's your job. So, there's seven in the band. They couldn't agree. So I said yes to everything because also Eastern Airlines had this special. You could fly all around the United States for $499, unlimited. So I figured you could go here, there, anywhere. And now I did not realize that when I finally did get a good booking from Chicago to Detroit, you had to go Chicago, Atlanta into Detroit. You always have to be through a hub. Well, anyways, I booked this tour. I looked at the band. I said, I got you $1 million. And they said, how do you expect us to do this? Well, they did it. Now, at the end of the tour, they lost all this money. I couldn't understand. They needed so many drugs to keep them going through the tour that they blew all the money. But every band started seeing the association working everywhere. So I got a call from the Turtles. I got a call from Gary Puck and Union Gap. I got a call from Spanky and our gang. And they said, will you represent us? Will you represent us? So I took on all these bands, and that's when I created the Happy Together Tour. In 1984, I came up with the idea of putting them all in a package and booked 15 shows through William Morris. And the shows started selling because people, I only told the bands to play hit songs. The movie The Big Chill came out. And when the movie The Big Chill came out, everybody was into nostalgia music. So back then, you got one great review in AP. We sold out every show. And that year, we continued doing the tour for 125 shows.
Wow. I bet that it was big at the casinos too, right?
Big in the casinos. It was big everywhere. Fairs. We would do all those fairs, those country fairs. So then I decided, you know what? I'm going to do it again. But the Turtles were so amazing, Flo and Eddie. Their show every night was so different. Right. And I said, you know, let me change it around. So that's when I changed it around and added the Grassroots and the Birds. Gary Clark's Birds were on that tour. And I did again 85 and again 125 shows. And then I'm staying in a hotel in Kansas City, Missouri. And because we had a show there and I would take 30 rooms at the Holiday Inn. So they were so nice. They gave me the suite, which is the whole top floor of the Holiday Inn in Kansas City. And I couldn't sleep. You know, you're in a big room. I couldn't sleep. And I put on the television and I'm watching a monkey episode. And I said, wow, that was the only show my dad, the Cantor, would allow me to watch. And I said, so I saw the monkeys. And I remember the monkeys. So I decided that I'm going to go after the monkeys. So I found out Peter Tork was teaching music on the west side of Manhattan. So I invited him to one of my Happy Together shows. And I said to him, can we put the Monkees back together? And he said to me, you know, we don't even own our name. And he says, but I'll take it as Meet Davey and I'll take it as Meet Mickey. So I found out that the name is owned by Columbia Pictures. Mm-hmm. So I call the phone. I call up the president of Columbia Pictures in L.A. because he was a football fan. I figured they all knew Vince Ferragamo because he took them to the Super Bowl a couple of years before that. And he said to me, you got to call a guy in New York. He controls the name. So the guy from New York said to me, take me to a Yankee game. So I take him to a Yankee game. And we're sitting at the Yankee game. And he says to me, what do you want to buy this Monkees name for? No one's bought in 20 years. I said, you know what? I just want to buy it for a year just to see, put them on an oldies tour. And let's see what happens. So he gave me a very cheap price. And because no one had touched in 20 years. Now I got the Monkees. I put the Grassroots. I took Gary Puck at the Union Gap. And I take, Herman Hermits. I brought the Herman Hermits without right. Peter Kuhn. And I'm ready to go on sale. And unbeknownst to me, I'm on the 7th floor, 7075 Broadway. On the 8th floor and 9th floor at the new fledging network called MTV. And I'm going up and down the stairs with Bob Pittman and all the other executives. And I turned to them and, you know, they would say hi to me. Most of them gave me a nasty look because the Giants would lose a football game. And everybody in New York, when the Giants lost and Phil Simms muffed the game, you know, they blame it on me because, you know, who knows what they bet. So I got a call and someone said, did you know MTV is doing the Monkees 24 hours? And I said, no. So I run upstairs to Bob Pittman and I say, hi, Mr. Pittman, I'm David Fisher. Oh, yeah, you're the sports agent. Sit down. What are you here for? And I said, well, I have an idea. I'm doing the Monkees on tour. And I thought maybe I heard you guys are doing, can we do something together? He says, I'll make a deal with you. You promote the Monkees on MTV to help build my new fledging network, MTV. That's what he called it, my new fledging network. And I'll promote your tour on TV. So he promotes my tour on TV. I go on sale, and I think I'm going to sell 3,000-4,000 tickets like I was so happy to get a tour. I sell 28,000 tickets in Chicago. I sell 30,000 tickets in Detroit at Pine Knob. It was incredible because we only would sell the seats and never the lawn. Well, it turned out that every little girl comes running home, and they're home at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the mothers are yelling at them, where were you all night? Mommy, mommy, I was waiting online to buy Monkees tickets. I can't, you know, and the mothers would say, wait a minute, I want to go. So they didn't know that it was an old band. They thought it was a new band on MTV. So the first 20 rows were these young girls screaming, and then it was their mothers, and the, you know, from 20 to 50. So really, that was incredible. That was an amazing year. In 1986.
Did you have any idea? Obviously
nothing,
not.
Nothing.
Be nostalgia for the Monkees?
Just nostalgia for the Monkees. It was really MTV. They decided, and I didn't know. And it was unbelievable. Danny, that was the tour of the year. I mean,
we sold out
Texas Stadium. We sold out San Diego Stadium. We sold out Foxborough. It was so huge. It was so huge. And I tell you, I used to rehearse all the shows at the Concord Hotel in the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I knew and got so big when they told me that they had to hold the show for 20 minutes. The state trooper said there was more traffic on Route 17 driving up to see if they could get in to see the Monkees. And they, you know, it was incredible how big they were and that year. And, you know, up of the year, I represented 9 of the New York Giants and they went to the Super Bowl.
Mm.
So I had a very, very busy year that year.
Well, I'm going to tell you something, and I hate to admit it, but I will because I'm supposed to be a rock guy, hard rock guy. I went to that Monkees tour at the Mann Music Center. The promoter was Stephen Starr, who I know very well, and he put me in the front row. I went nuts.
And now he's a restaurateur.
Yep.
And he's a very successful restaurateur. And I'll tell you, it's so funny. That Monk, I was at the man, I remember being there because I decided that I was going to take the family on the road, and I got a tour bus. Hmm. And I parked my tour bus in the back just for me and the family. And that lasted about 3 days because they didn't know what to do on the road and they were falling over the bus. But I'll tell you, in this film, if you ask me the biggest question that people have asked me, they start off with the Monkees. The Monkees, the Monkees, Monkees. And that leads to why they're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, everyone loved the Monkees. The Monkees gave you a feeling of happiness.
Why aren't the Monkees in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I know.
Bias?
Well, you know, everyone has their political opinion. But the Monkees, Denny, to this day, a Monkee song goes on and you just smile. Yeah. And you know, Davey and I were very close. And again, I spoke to him a few months before he passed away. He came to see me. And I'll tell you what a type of great guy he was. I mean, you knew him too. He loved his fans more than anything.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he came to see me. And he showed me a children's book. And about 3 days later, you get something in the mail. He sent you a book that he signed to my daughter he just met. Mm-hmm. He loved the fans. He loved people. And I think it's a catastrophe now to see Mike Nesmith going out and calling himself the Monkees and touring.
Right.
To me, that's, you know, like, that really bothers me. Because
did you see what Mickey's doing?
Mickey's re-recording Nesmith songs.
Right.
I know. It's like, you know, anything to forget Davy Jones. And Davy Jones was really, Mickey's the lead singer. And Mickey's a great guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, obviously Mickey, you know, he's Mr. Monkey. But, you know, and he has the rights to do all this. But, and they're trying to perpetuate the name. Right. So, you know, God bless them. The Monkees are just, they're amazing. And I'll tell you something. After that tour, I'll never forget, I was sitting with the Rolling Stones accountant. And Bill Z. And during that tour, he was telling me that they were motivated to go back out and tour. Everybody, every band said, if the Monkees could do this, so could we. And it brought back so many bands.
Yeah.
It brought back so many bands.
Well, I always wondered how that Monkees thing came together. I knew the story because I've known David for a long time, but hearing him tell it's just a great story. And he also did the Ringo and the All-Star, which we're going to hear about now. And that's a great story too. I mean, he's had some great ideas, but I just remembered, like I said, I've known David for a long time. This is a funny thing I told him. I remember telling him that he made it into the Guinness Book of World Records. And he said, well, what are you talking about? And I remembered when they aired the Beatles' first appearance on Ed Sullivan, I think about 10 years ago. You remember that? They did the whole show, the whole hour show.
Yes,
with the Beatles.
Yes, I do. Yes.
It's also out on home video. So
right, right.
Okay, so if you know who else was on the show that day, was Tess O'Shea, the plate guy.
Right.
And the Broadway version, which wasn't on Broadway yet, was on in England, in London, of Oliver. And the guy who had the lead in Oliver was Davy Jones. So Davy Jones was on that show as well. You know, it's like a 16-year-old.
Wow. Yeah.
So I said to David, I said, you're you just became the first guy that's managed two people that were guests on the Beatles episode of Ed Sullivan.
Right.
He looked at me like, what?
Well, I don't think anybody remembers anything that happened in their own lives before they saw the Beatles. So how would they, all I remember is Sorry Girls, He's Married. And I remember turning.
Well, Davy Jones remembers it. He remembers it. But
Well, sure he does. Yeah. But I remember I looked at my mother and I was like, he's married. And my mother's like, you can like him anyway.
Anyway, it's a great story. So you got to hear it. So we're going to play this and then we'll wrap up. This is David Fischoff talking about the genesis of the Ringo Starr and the All-Star Band.
I've been told when a boy kisses a girl, take a trip around the world.
Ringo decides who we'd like to have in the band, and the songs are the hits, and everybody up here has great songs. There's really no audition, I don't believe, right?
No, there's no audition. The criterion is that you've had a hit sometime this or the last century. And I think, I need a keyboard, I need a guitar, and we need a bass player, and we need someone wacky on the far end. And, you know, that's how I put it together, really. I mean, there's a lot of management sending names of musicians. I feel some musicians and some musicians mention it. And I just have to sit there in the end and say, well, I think that would be a great combination for Ringo and the All-Stars. And then everyone's contacted, and then we meet up here, and I don't know if it's going to work the day before we get here, but so far, for the last 23 years, it's worked.
I'm gonna try with a little help from my friends.
Ooh. Let's talk about the Ringo tour.
Okay.
How did that come about?
So I'm doing, after the Monkees, I came out, I went to see this movie, Dirty Dancing. And I said, wow, I said, that reminded me of the Catskills. Why don't I take these dancers and put them on the road with Bill Medley and Eric Carmen, and I'll create a Dirty Dancing live tour. And no one had ever taken a movie out before.
Right.
So I called my friend Dennis Arfa, who you know represents probably the best agent in our business to this day. And I said, Dennis, I have this idea to do it, and you represent Eric Carmen. And so we worked together. I said, come on, let's do, be my partner. Let's do this. So we did this. And the business model was I would go get a corporate sponsor. Back in those days, the way the business was, I'd find a corporate sponsor who would be interested in putting their name to the tour. And we'd give them tickets. They would get meet and greets. They would get everything and all the corporate access and their name everywhere. And then I would sign the artist to X amount of shows, X amount of weeks, go to an agency like William Morris. In this case, went to Dennis's agency, and he would book the tour. And we would book as many shows as we could book. Well, the president of Pepsi was so thrilled that how Dirty Dancing did great for them. And because they, Mountain Dew was the corporate sponsor, you know, he came to me and he said, hey, you know, we want you to put together the a tour for us. It's the 25th anniversary of the Pepsi generation. So I came to him with some different ideas. And one of the ideas I came to him is, how about I try to get Ringo Starr and put him on the road with an all-star band. And I went back to him and he said, I love it. Let's do it. And he says, and he gave me a lot of money. And he said, but I want to be a partner. So before you take any money, I want to split it with you. But at least I had a $1 million offer. So I took the $1 million offer and I wrote a letter to Ringo Starr. And he had took about 3-4 months to respond. His lawyer called me up and said, you got to come to England and meet him and you'll pitch your idea. So I went to England, and I remember back then we didn't have cell phones. So I was stuck in my room waiting for a week. You know, because I was waiting for that phone call when I'm going to come to meet him. So I bought every Beatle book possible to read in case he asked me a question. And I just studied. So he didn't ask me one question, but I just read and read and read and read. And I walked into his office, and his wife was there, Barbara. And I said, you know, this is my concept, my idea. And I played him a commercial, you know, like, it's coming live in concert, Ringo and the All-Star Band. And I wanted him to feel what it sound like. Mm. And I brought him an ad for a newspaper ad. And they said, I was thinking the same thing. And then we talked about some artists. And about a week or two later, his lawyer called me and said he agreed to the deal. And that's how I put that together.
Well, there's been, I think, 14 different lineups
right
over the years. And yes, some of the people, I tried to pick the ones that you probably didn't know or whatever, but Dr. John, who knew?
Yeah.
Slash, of course, Zach Starkey was in the band. Bonnie Raitt, Stevie Nicks, from the E Street Band, Clarence, Max, and Nils. And even Bruce played one show. And I tried to find this somewhere, but I found no recording of this anywhere. He performed Get Back with Billy Preston, who, if you remember, like, you know, was on the original. So that would have been, yeah, something really to see, but I can't find that anywhere. But yeah, and that's just tip of the iceberg. If you want to read a who's who of the musicians that played with Ringo, your mouth will drop open. It's really quite a list.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd like to thank David Fischoff. You can get more information by going to his website, rockandrollfantasycamp.com. Go see the movie. You'll have a good time with that. And when the rock camps, David told me, well, you heard him say that, when the rock camps start going back in person, because right now, of course, they're doing them online, Anita and I are going to go and we're going to cover it live. So we're going to have all the counselors on and it should be a good time. So anyway, thanks for having for stopping by. Just, you know, if you feel like getting in touch with us, we're at all the usual places. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Send us an email if you want. Hello@therockpodcast.com. And I think I got everything in there. Anita, until next time.
Okay, see you then.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.